and cover Irish and Welsh. And we did sometimes get them. And I had great difficulty persuading Gustinčić, who was a member of the Central Committee of the Yugoslav Communist Party, that Irish and Welsh were really unintelligible, you know, even to quite intelligent Englishmen. And there were some Welsh people, you know, whose mums wrote to them in Welsh, you know, and probably couldn't have written to them in English.
You censored the incoming mail as well.
Yes, we censored incoming mail too, yes, yes, yes. I think, I forget what happened there. I know we had long, long discussions about this. We had lots of discussions with Gustinčić, who was a real hardliner, you know. Gustinčić wanted to censor almost everything, you know. We were always trying to persuade him to waive a point. There was a constant tussle between, shall I say, the innate liberalism of the English and Americans, which he very much despised, you know, and the hardlinism of the Eastern Europeans, Eastern Central Europeans, you know, who thought that we were terribly, terribly, what should I say, terribly lax, you know, nothing like harsh enough, you know, in our censorship. What might, well, I think it's only marginally amusing, is that we had to confiscate all literature that might be regarded as pornographic, you know, on the grounds that the troops would want to desert at once if they saw all these glamour girls. He used to call it Rizras. We had to confiscate all Rizras. Rizras must not be allowed to the front. But yes, it's funny, Gustinčić, I learned an awful lot in Spain, not all of it about war, but Gustinčić was really exactly like an Austro-Hungarian official, you know. I mean, he was one of nature's bureaucrats. The fact he was a communist was, you know, the way the cards had gone. But he was fussy, he was particular, he loved to put you in the wrong, you know, if he possibly could, you know. He'd come into the office and he'd find fault, you know. And if he could make you feel a fool, he'd always do so, you know. But actually, he was not he wasn't a dislikable man. He wasn't an entirely dislikable man, let's put it this way. He was a difficult man to work for, but not an entirely dislikable man. But there is a revolutionary arrogance, you know, and a revolutionary snobbery, which is just as strong as other variants of these, you know, and you meet it. I mean, Gustinčić could be a real, you know, when he felt so disposed. I don't know what happened to him, because a lot of these chaps, of course, were later purged by Stalin, which I wouldn't wish on anybody, you know, but Gustinčić was one of the people who went to Russia at the end of the Spanish War, and I remember thinking, you know, lucky chap. I wouldn't have thought so if I knew what I know now, you know. He was a real tough bird. Of course, he was too old to go to the front, but he was very, very conscious of his rank, you know. He was very conscious of his rank, he was very conscious of his importance, and although he had to be a little bit careful about this, he didn't think much of the Spaniards. You know, there's a certain revolutionary snobbery, you know, that thinks Spaniards don't know how to run this, you know. You know, Spaniards are too anarchistic, you know, Spaniards are too libertarian. They don't really know how you run revolutionary wars. We Eastern Europeans do, you know, we know all about it. And of course, you never quite knew whether these people might have been cover Russians, because there were no Russians in Spain officially. Of course, there were. But there were no Russians in Spain officially. And if they wanted cover, there were obvious advantages in saying that they were Slovenes or Croats or what you will, you know, where it would be almost impossible for anybody who wasn't a Slav expert to know. Anyway, people like Gustinčić spoke Russian fluently and had come from Russia. You know, they'd come from the Yugoslav immigration in Russia. And a lot of the top people had come from the... a lot of the top people were East European communists who were domiciled in Russia and who'd been sent early in the Spanish War. That's where very many of them came from. But not very many. Some did, but not very many turned up after World War II. And I think they may have disappeared in the Burge, you know, a lot of them. But of course, I don't know.
John Peake said, yes, at Loughborough, he had information of a number of them.
Yes.
Yes.
Actually, this is not relevant to my experiences, Ben, but what really worried me about that, I went and said to John Peake afterwards, I enjoyed your speech, I thought you did that very well. I thought you handled it very well, I said. And he said, well, several people here told me they had no idea that international brigaders had been purged in Eastern Europe. And I said, I find that quite incredible, you know, because these facts have been known for years. You know, I mean, they've been known for about 25 years. You know. I said, I find that quite incredible. But John Peake said to me, it's not incredible, he said, if you always read the Daily Worker or the Morning Star, you know, and you believe that all the rest of the press is lies, you have your own picture, you know, and there you are. That's your picture. Anyway, we'll leave that because that's another story. Yes, oh, he was a hard man, Gustinchich. I think I will tell you a story. When I was at Loughborough, I told that nice girl who interviewed me that I wouldn't told her not to put this on tape because I thought it was too damaging. I think perhaps I'll ask you to turn the tape off and or
why
can't you?
Why don't we record it and then we can remove it afterwards?
Yes, all right. Well, I'll tell you the story because it's a shocker, really. It was perfectly legal for us to supplement our rations by buying on the open market. There's nothing illegal about this. But there was one very nice Spanish working class comrade called El Lola, who came from Madrid. And he was a member of the Spanish Communist Party. He was very simple. You know, he was a simple soul. He wasn't a complicated man at all. And every time we discussed this, when we had meetings, he always said, I think this is quite immoral. There are children in Barcelona who are dying of hunger, and here we are supplementing our rations. And he didn't say this once, you know. He tended to say this every time we had a meeting. You know, Gustinchich wanted to have him expelled from the Communist Party, you know, for not being obedient, for not being docile, you know. And we all said, oh, you can't do that, you know, including, if I may say so, his fellow Yugoslavs, you know, said, Comrade Gustinchich, this is impossible, you know. And I can see him saying, liberalismo putrido, he said, putrid liberalism, he said, you know. Well, I think that can go on the tape, yes. Yes, you can leave that on the tape. It doesn't give you a very, if I may say so, it doesn't give you a very pretty picture of what some of these chaps are like, who are like.
You'll find that in any sort of war or not.
Oh, surely.
I think this is very interesting because these are personal details that only you know.
Yes. I'll tell you another thing. I'll backtrack. This is not when I was in the censorship. This is long before when I was in the research bureau, the Bureau de Recherche in Albacete. We had a nice chief whom we all liked, who was supposedly a German from Brazil, a person called Joschka, you know. And one day, quite inexplicably, Joschka was disgraced, you know, and sent off to the front, you know, deprived of his rank and sent off to the front. And none of us knew why. And the French group said, oh, this is not fair, you know, we'll organize a petition. So the French group got up a petition, and, you know, we all signed it, you know, we thought, well, these chaps got up a petition, you know, we really can't fail to sign it. And two or three days later, a chap came down from the headquarters. I think he was called, gone for the moment, anyway, sorry. Anyway, he was one of the very top brass. And they all, of course, had nom de guerre. I think it was Comrade Gomez, but it may not be. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But Comrade Gomez, who was German, by the way, came down and he gave us a great, you know, a great wigging, you know, in German, which was then translated into French, you know, and then translated into Spanish. We didn't bother about other languages, but we had them, in, you know, we had them in the three, German, French, and Spanish, saying, you know, you're militants and you all know there can be oppression in armies, but of course there can't be oppression in a people's army. In a people's army, you know, oppression in a people's army is a contradiction in terms. If it's a Volksarmee, you can't have oppression, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, well, that's a line of old, you know, that's a line of old cobblers. I remember thinking that I didn't say so. But it was not uncharacteristic, you know, of, shall I say, hardline thinking. Anyway, he rebuked us very much. He said, if we've disgraced Joschka, it's because of very good reasons, which we can't reveal, which could have been true. And I'm not saying it wasn't. I mean, Joschka may have been a Gestapo agent, for all I know. I never shall know. You know, we were given not a word of explanation, and we weren't expected to object to our boss, you know, being suddenly disgraced, you know, with no explanation given. We weren't expected. All I can say is I think we were jolly, compared with what happens in Eastern Europe, I think we were jolly lightly treated. I think we could have been in very severe trouble if this had been somewhere like Czechia, you know, or further east. Very severe trouble. And suppose I'd be telling you the story if it had been further east. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. There's more I want to tell you. I think I've probably told you most of the stories I've got in mind.
I'd be interested in character sketches of some of the other people you worked with.
Yes.
If you remember, British or foreign.
Well, they were
some of the people.
Yes.
Even that we knew at Loughborough, you know. at the time of the war.
Yes, not very many of them. Of the ones at Loughborough, the one I really knew at the time of the war, or knew slightly, you know, was Bill Alexander, of whom I've always had a very great regard. Because he was very brave and he was very cheerful and he was very friendly and very liked and, of course, incredibly tough. I thought some of the funny stories he told against himself were very funny, you know, particularly, you know, making all his steps double out in Egypt, you know, with whatever it was, you know, with the machine guns on their shoulders, you know. But I've always had a great regard for him. But oh, I knew some extraordinary characters. Yes, I'll tell you about one remarkable character I knew. He may still be alive, but I've completely lost him, unfortunately. There was a most remarkable character called... let me get it right now. I'll have to get it right for you. Called Donald... Douglas, that's right. Donald Douglas, who was the illegitimate son of a well-known art dealer called Langdon Douglas. You know, who in the days of Duveen and Co., you know, was quite a name to play with in the west of London. And Donald Douglas was a most extraordinary person, very, very good-looking indeed, and very, very talented. His father sent him to Stowe, where he was expelled because he wouldn't obey order, because he wouldn't do what his housemaster told him. He just refused. He went at one time to the Royal College of Music or the Royal Academy of Music, I forget which. Apparently was a very, very good pianist. And he also, his father managed to get him into Cambridge, where he started reading philosophy with Wittgenstein. He was very, very talented, as you'll see, in several fields. He was, among other things, aeroplane mad. And when he was in Cambridge, he actually bought an aeroplane, an old crock for £100. I can't help thinking it must be a death trap, but he did. He was also in Cambridge a member of the ATC. In those days, wasn't it? Yes. Anyway, the Spanish War came, and he said, to hell with Cambridge. He'd been there for 1 year, by the way. So as he rushed to Spain, this was in the very early days before the International Brigade were organized, and he joined the 5th Regiment, which was the Communist Party militia, and he fought in the Battle of Madrid. And he got a bullet right through the hand here, you know, which disabled one of his hands, and then he couldn't play the piano. Anyway, he was hospitalized and sent back to England, and then he volunteered again. And he came out to Spain. I met him in Albacete in the autumn of 1937. He'd come out to Albacete again, and they looked at his hand. They said, well, he'd come out, by the way, hoping he'd be allowed to join the Marlborough Squadron and fly planes. But in fact, nobody joined the Marlborough Squadron and flew planes. You know, this just wasn't on. I don't know how you got into that, nor did he. Anyway, that was not on. Anyway, they said to him, look, you can't go to the front with a hand like that. We'll have to give you a job in the base. And I was working with him at one time in the research bureau. Then he got very restless, and so they made him secretary to a hospital in Catalonia at a place called Espluga Francoli. And he got very restless indeed, Donald Douglas. And he jumped on a lorry and deserted to the front. Desertion to the front was not unknown. It was hardly military discipline, but it was not unknown. And there he served at the front. I think he was in the signal section, that's right. He was in the signal section with a chap of White Russian origin called Jim Ruskin. And he stayed in Spain over about another 6 months or so and was finally repatriated, spring of 1938 he was repatriated. They were handed over to a group of French nuns, you know, and taken across France and sent back to England. Unfortunately, I've lost touch with him, but he was brilliant. You know, his knowledge of, if I may say so, the moral science tripos of Cambridge had put its finger on Donald Douglas, you know. His knowledge of philosophy was remarkable. But he very soon quarrelled with the Communist Party when he got back to England. He quarrelled with them during World War II, on the grounds that they wouldn't be rude enough to Winston Churchill, you know, after the alliance with Russia, and he joined the Commonwealth instead, Dick Heckland's Commonwealth, and that's the last I ever heard of him. But he really was a character. He may still be alive, but Donald Douglas is his name. He may still be alive, but if you're listening, he really loved danger. He joined the RAF, by the way, at the beginning of World War II, as an air gunner, in spite of the hand, and they slung him out after 6 months, because he walked around, you know, with daily workers sticking out of his pocket, you know. He was so obviously, a communist that they discharged him after 6 months. Then he got a job as a ship's cook during World War II. He did absurd things. He went through a form of marriage with an Austrian refugee ballet dancer, nice girl, so to give her British nationality, of course. And I'm afraid that's all I can tell you about Donald, but if you really want a character, Donald Douglas is a character. But what he's done since the war, I've no idea. But I don't think I've got any anecdotes about Bill Alexander, not really, except I liked him. I can't think of any, you know, I can't think of any particularly good stories. I'll tell you who was a charming character, whom I met several times in the Spanish War, and who's still alive. You may know about him. It was a person called Miles Tomlin, who had been music master at Beedale's. Miles Tomlin is something of a poet, you know. He came to Spain, he had his recorder with him. Of course, whenever he played on his recorder, you know, we always got a group of admiring Spaniards around us, you know. Yes, he was the most charming character. He's still around. In fact, he's the father-in-law. He's the father of the Nicholas Tomlin who was killed, and the father-in-law of Claire Tomlin who's on the New Statesman. He's still around. He was a very, very nice character. He served in the anti-tanks in the Spanish War along with Bill Alexander, and he was always very cheerful. I'm sorry to say that when I was in the research bureau, we got a list of dead, and there was Miles Tomlin, you know, on the list, so we had to put him down on the list to kill his national brigaders. He walked into El Pasete about 4 months later. He was very surprised to find he'd been dead, you know, and we were very pleased to see him, you know.
Had you notified his family that he was dead?
Fortunately, I don't think so. I hope to God we hadn't. Certainly we hadn't. I didn't know whether other people had, but fortunately we hadn't. He was divorced. But Nicholas, you know, the journalist, was about six. He used to write long, long letters to Nicholas. You know, they were quite a feature, the Spanish War. He was a very nice person. Who else did I know of interest? One surprise, by the way, I did meet Laurie Lee in Spain, who apparently is very unwilling to say anything about the Spanish War, so Bill Alexander tells me. But, of course, I didn't know Laurie Lee was going to become a famous poet, you know, when I was on the Milicias de la Cultura, you know, the educational militia in Tarazona, Laurie Lee was there at headquarters. He had come out to Spain, presumably through the Communist Party, but he wasn't a communist. You know, he'd never been communist. And he got fed up playing across France in this group, and he knew Spain already, you know, because he'd wandered around Spain with his... was it his fiddle? I can't remember, or his flute, I forget which it was. Fiddle, I think. He'd wandered around Spain with his fiddle before, you know. So he went across the Pyrenees by himself. And, of course, the Republican frontier guards picked him up and thought he was a spy, you know, and kept him in prison. I can't remember how long he was in prison, but I think a fortnight or something like that. And then, apparently, they were satisfied he wasn't a spy, and they let him come out to Tarazona. He never went to the front. But he was enormously popular, you know, because he used to sit in front of the billet there, you know, playing on his fiddle, you know, and we had all the village kids, you know, in an admiring throng. He got on with them very well, of course, because he, I forget how much Spanish he spoke, but, you know, he was able to converse quite easily with them. He enjoyed it. But they must have repatriated him very soon after, because I never came across him again. And I notice in his biographies that the references to the Spanish War are very, very short. You know, they're sort of half-sentence references. You know, he prefers not to talk about it. It's an episode that he's suppressed. I can't think of anybody else for the moment. Perhaps I ought to tell you about the return journey. You've probably had other accounts of that.
We've left you in military censorship office.
Oh, so you have in Godalia. Yes, let me pick up from there. Well, in due course, of course, the Franco breaks through to the sea. But just before Franco breaks through to the sea, we evacuated in a hurry to Barcelona. And that's where I spent about 6 months in 1938. You know? And then we
what were you doing?
I was still in the military censorship. We simply transferred the military censorship and all the records to Barcelona. And I think all the records came from Albacete as well. The headquarters of the International Brigade was now Barcelona. This is where everything was concentrated. And I stayed there until they decided to disband the International Brigades in the autumn of 1938. I didn't really want to go back to England, but there was nothing very much I could do about it, you know. And there was some suggestion that I might be given a civilian job in the Spanish Postal Service, which I thought was quite a good idea, but nothing ever came of it. Anyway, in due course, I was given instructions to go and join the British Battalion, which was now at Ripoll, which is in the foothills of the Pyrenees. And that's where I met up with them again. And from Ripoll, well, I stayed in Ripoll about 3 days. By that time, by the way, things were getting very bad in Spain. Oh, well, I should have known, but I was unrealistic. By that time, the civilians really were short of food, because when we were in Ripoll, you know, we used to go up. We used to, I think we probably messed in the church, but I'm not sure. At any rate, we used to go up to the mess, you know, and draw our rations, which were mostly lentils. Sometimes a tiny bit of meat for flavouring, but mostly lentils. And as we came out, we were surrounded by village children, you know. And you couldn't really give to these village children, because about 17 of them, you know. If you could only corner one, you know, you might be able to slip them a little bit. But they were all demanding food. They were extremely hungry. And I remember those last months in Barcelona, whenever I talked to Spaniards, by that time I talked to Spaniards quite easily, whenever I talked to Spaniards, they used to say to me, when does the war end? You know, and I used to say to them, well, of course, the war will end when we win, you know. But what they meant and what I should have realized was, you know, that there was extreme war fatigue, you know, and that the mood when they would accept even Franco, you know, was not very far away, you know, that that morale was running down and people were very, very tired and food was very short.
But in your particular job and position, were you unable to see that at the time?
Well, I should have seen it. I should have been more realistic. You know, I should have been more realistic. I thought, not altogether absurdly, you know, that Britain and France would change their minds, you know, that they would go over to opposition to Hitler instead of appeasement, which of course they did, but too late for us, you know. That they changed their minds, that they would go over to opposition, and when they changed their minds, they would allow arms. Well, food was allowed through anyway, but they would allow arms through to Spain, you know, and this would be the end of Franco. This is what I thought, and that wasn't, you know, wholly absurd. Though after Munich, things deteriorated very, very quickly because there was no more Russian assistance after Munich. That had all dried up, and Britain and France were appeasing Hitler, if anything, even more than ever. In the immediate months after Munich, you know, until Prague. Prague was just too late to save Spain, actually. Why the Spanish government decided, why Negrín's government decided to wind up the international brigades is mysterious. Because, you see, the reason they gave of the League of Nations, which is absurd, is that if we wind up the international brigades, the Germans and Italians would be withdrawn from Franco's side. Well, of course, everybody knew they wouldn't be, you know. So the question I ask myself, and I don't know the answer, is why did Negrín do it? And I guess, but I could be absolutely wrong about this, I guess it was probably Stalin. Stalin took the view that Spain was now expendable and a write-off, and the important thing to do was to have these trained cadres back in their own countries, you know, in view of the imminence of World War II. That's my guess. The Spanish gamble had really been on the assumption that Britain and France would give Russia the green light, you know, and that there would be a government in Spain with a very, very strong, not a communist government, but government with a very strong communist component, you know, and this would be a reliable ally in the Second War. And this wasn't going to happen because Britain and France wouldn't play, and therefore, you know, write-offs are write-offs. But that's pure guesswork, you know. Nobody will know whether this is true until we see the Russian archives. And I shall never see them. You might live to see them. I'm sure
how
I shall.
How obvious to you in Spain was the German intervention?
Well, we knew a lot about it. Mind you, of course, we made big propaganda out of it. I mean, you know, all our propaganda is featured. But a very great deal was known about the German intervention, and a very great deal was known about the Italian. You know, these were not secrets. You know, I mean, these were not secrets. I couldn't have quantitatively told you how much intervention there was, and it wasn't likely to tell you how much Russian there was. But these were not secrets. These things everybody knew. You know, there was massive German intervention, there was massive Italian. The Russian was curious because, of course, the Russians officially weren't there. You know, so they all had to have covers. And of course, as far as I know, I never met any. You know, unless Kostinchik was Russian, which I don't know. But I mean, as far as I know, I never met any. I did once meet one, by the way. At least one I think is probably Russian. I acted as interpreter once to Will Painter, the miners' leader now, who's now just writing his memoirs, by the way. And I acted as interpreter for him once with when I was at El Basete with a person called General Belov. And I think he was probably a Russian. And there was a little bit of argument between General Belov and Will Painter about the way the British battalion was being run, you know, and whether certain people ought to be withdrawn and sent back to England, which in fact they were, you know. And I met Will Painter years and years after the Spanish War and said to him, well, tell me, who was Belov? Do you know anything about him? And he just shrugged his shoulders and said, well, you know, Stalin said that these people had all been contaminated by Western ideas, you know. And he said, but I don't know. And I said, well, if you don't know, I'm sure I shall never know. You know, I think Belov was probably purged, but and I don't, A, I don't know who he was, you know, and B, I don't know. I mean, I can't ever document this. But I think he was probably purged, because so many of them were. But that apart, of course, I never met the Russians. We used rudely to call all Russian equipment Mexikansky. Because Mexico didn't belong to the non-intervention agreement, and theoretically she sold arms to Spain, but I think the stuff that came from Mexico was a mere dribble, you know. I don't think the stuff that came from Mexico is significant. The significant stuff was Russian. Anyway, I went to Rapal, where the British battalion was. This was in December 1938. And there we stayed for a few days. Sam Wilde was in charge, and Bill Cooney and Bob Cooney. They were the big chaps then, you know. And after I'd been in Rapal for about 5 days, 6 days, 7 days, whatever it was, you know, the news came that we were to entrain and go back to England. So they put us all on a train, and the last Spanish town we went through was a place called Puigcerdá, and we went out of Spain. We crossed into France into a little town called La Tour de Carol, which was where there were lashings of food. You know, I mean, talk about, you know, coming from starvation to food. It was horrid, really, you know, when you thought of those poor chaps the other side, you know, nearly starving, and they're in Spain. If I may say so, a great many injudicious international brigaders were terribly sick. You know, they went and had a good meal in the restaurant, the station restaurant there, you know, which they just couldn't take. I was a bit more cautious than they. I mean, I also ate in the restaurant, but I was a good deal more cautious, you know, the amount I was willing to risk, you know, after many months of lentils, you know. And then they put us...